Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded. Please be seated. Good morning. We have today some students from Cedarburg High School. Would those students please stand? Well, welcome. And your teacher, Hayden Knight, attended the 2000 and 2007 Teachers Institute. Is Hayden Knight here or is...
No.
Good. All right.
He's over at the Institute.
Is that the State Bar? Good. You may be seated. Thank you. These students are here with a program, a national award-winning program, sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. This program invites high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they agree to come, they're sent the briefs in the case that they will hear. And the students may engage in some other activities relating to this case. The students also meet with a justice of this court after the second oral argument each morning. And everyone is invited to that discussion. The discussion relates to the procedures of this court, not the substantive issue of the cases that we hear. Now, the marshal has a summary of this case that you're about to hear, if anyone would like it, if you're not familiar with the case. All right? Raise your hand if you want a summary. Okay. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. Justice Wilcox is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. To Justice Wilcox's right is Justice Patrick Crooks. On the far right, Justice Patience Robensack. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. And on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we'll proceed with our cases. The first case is 05AP2962FT. Standing for Fast Track, DeHart versus Wisconsin Mutual Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of Wisconsin Mutual Insurance Company is Randall M. Is it Skiles?
Skiles, English pronunciation.
And arguing on behalf of the DeHarts is Lance Trollope. Mr. Skiles, you may proceed. You have 25 minutes for your argument, 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel, and guests of the court. As the length of the briefs indicate and the number of cases cited, there's a relatively small portion of law that has to be dealt with in this case. The basic issue is when you have a allegedly uninsured motorist that allegedly has contact some distance away from a hit and miss with the insured vehicle, does that qualify under the statute? And the statute, of course, reads, an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident. Now, this court in Romanchek had a chance to effectively eliminate any impact requirement from the uninsured motorist statute. That's what was urged by the appellant.
Does the statute ever say that it's the insured's vehicle that is involved in the hit-and-run? Doesn't it just say that it could be any vehicle? In other words, under 632.32, and this is 2B, what does the statute exactly say? Your opponent says that it does not say that the insured vehicle must be the one that is hit.
Well, Your Honor, if I were to parse like a noted lawyer Bill Clinton, I could parse this language to indicate that the vehicle involved in the hit is not even the unidentified one. You could parse the language of the statute to say an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident that in a miss-and-run accident, the hit is when the insured vehicle leaves the road and cracks into a tree or rolls over into a ditch or something similar. I mean, if you're going to read the statute that way, you can divorce the unified motor vehicle from hitting anything.
Well, in one of the briefs, they gave the example of a hit occurring, say, in the morning in one county, say, Dane County, and then they hit somebody, and then there was a miss later on for another vehicle on the same roadway. Would that qualify?
Well,
does it make any
not.
Difference?
And, Your Honor, to be rather topical, what happened here last week struck me that you could have an accident in westbound Beltline, someone flees, and someone says they're startled by that in eastbound Beltline, and because they're startled, they rear-end a vehicle in front of you and say, well, the impact in the other lane qualifies as the hit. I want to claim unidentified motorist coverage, and in a blizzard, you could have just an unending cascade of claims arising out of such a circumstance. And if the legislature had intended that, they just would have chosen the original formulation, an unidentified motor vehicle involved in an accident.
So the position you have, there must be a hit on the insured vehicle.
An impact on the insured vehicle.
But why doesn't this fall under Smith then?
Well, Smith, as I read the case, the factual situation was the unidentified vehicle A struck vehicle number B that did have a physical impact on the insured vehicle. These facts are the first reported case where there was no impact on the insured vehicle and uninsured motorist coverage is found. Smith, there was a bona fide impact on the insured vehicle.
Mr. Skiles, if I could, I want to make sure that, at least from my perspective, this case is properly before. She made an argument right at the beginning where you said that the vehicle allegedly struck another vehicle. Now, my understanding is that this case is here on summary judgment. And I want to make sure we're not dealing with any genuine issues of material fact.
Well, Your Honor, it isn't here on a summary judgment posture, but this is something that if we get into the whole issue of the public policy of fraud would come into play, you know, if we get into that area. The fact that, as I cited in my recitation of facts, the plaintiff gave testimony that there were two vehicles that came towards her. I mean, so how can we even be sure that the vehicle that she claims drove her off the road was the one that allegedly knocked off the mirror on the vehicle somewhere down the road?
For purposes of this appeal, I guess this is where my question is why. For purposes of this appeal, are you disputing that there was an accident that occurred between the oncoming vehicle and the vehicle that was allegedly some distance in front of the plaintiff in this case? Are you disputing that here or no?
Your Honor, I think that the factual circumstance is that she hears a thump. When she gets home, she sees the mirror is damaged. You can try and draw a conclusion from that. There must have been impact, but that is jumping to a conclusion.
Let me ask the question differently. General rule in summary judgment is there are no material issues of fact. Yeah. According to these briefs, there is a material issue of fact. There may be a material issue of fact, whether that first car was ever hit, which unidentified vehicle hit it, etc. Therefore, it might appear to somebody reading the briefs that this is not a case for summary judgment because there are issues that you all would say are material facts if you had to go to trial. So I would suggest that perhaps this case, which is perfectly acceptable under summary judgment procedure, the first thing you do is treat it as a motion to dismiss. And in a motion to dismiss, you accept all the facts of the complaint as alleged are true. And you would argue, even if you accepted all the facts alleged as true, namely that the unidentified motor vehicle hit the mirror of the first car but did not strike any other car, right?
Correct.
Even if you accept all those facts as true, they don't state a cause of action.
That's what Wisconsin Mutual is arguing.
So this is really a motion to dismiss, because that's how you deal with summary judgment. You first deal with it as a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim of action. And if that doesn't work, then you need evidence, then are there material facts. So would you accept that we treat this as a motion to dismiss for purposes of?
Sure, Your Honor, because our position is that even if there was contact with that vehicle,
it doesn't
the absence of contact with the insured vehicle means there's no claim.
So you take as true paragraph 6 of the complaint, which states that Wendy DeHart was a seat-belted driver of a car traveling on Highway 64 in Langlade County. And while traveling on Highway 64, the plaintiff's vehicle was forced off the road by an automobile driven by an unknown driver, which crossed the center line into Wendy DeHart's lane of travel after striking another vehicle traveling in a line of traffic directly in front of Ms. DeHart's vehicle. You take that as true?
Well, if you're analyzing on motion to dismiss, the interesting thing that's sort of been lost sight of on appeal is that the trial court, in granting summary judgment, looked at all the facts and said, because of the number of cars in between, whatever happened was so attenuated from the miss and run, it couldn't be connected.
Well, that's an answer, but it's not a direct answer to my question. Do you take as true what I read with regard to paragraph 6 for purposes of today's argument?
Yes.
Okay. So we can proceed from that.
May I ask just sort of a policy discussion? If I were driving east in my lane of traffic and a vehicle traveling west, it's a two-lane highway, is coming directly toward me, and I maybe honk the horn and it keeps coming, what is the driver, what am I supposed to do in that situation?
Well, take evasive action.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, depending on the position of that vehicle, you could either go to the left or to the right.
Well, if I went to the left, wouldn't I potentially be in the other driver's lane, or if he shifts back or she shifts back? I mean, it could be a head-on crash then, couldn't it?
Yes. And we've seen those circumstances come to court.
Isn't the more logical thing to try to get off the lane entirely? To the right.
Well, I think that would be a fact-specific circumstance. If you saw the car angling towards your right, I think it would make more sense for you to go to the left. If the car's coming dead on you, then you've got a 50-50 choice as to what that car's going to do.
Well, in either event, if I'm hurt and my car is badly damaged as a result of this evasive maneuver, how do I ensure myself that my injuries and my vehicle's injuries will be covered by my policy?
Well, it's not covered under the standard policy.
Well, I mean, is there an alternative to the standard policy that's available to people? Well,
Your Honor, if you have collision coverage, your collision is going to be covered. And obviously, if you have health insurance, as most people either have health insurance through the government providing it or through some private payer, that provides for your own injuries. But there are obviously many circumstances in life in which you can sustain injury and not have insurance coverage. Slip and fall in the street.
So I should not be looking to my automobile insurance policy for the coverage.
Not in that circumstance, not without an impact.
And
well, would you sell me the policy? Could you sell me an endorsement if I called you and said, I want miss and run insurance? You know those guys up at the Supreme Court? They've taken away all my rights. No insurance coverage. I mean, what am I going to do now? So why don't I, just like Justice Frost, you heard him on the net. He doesn't want to go into that other lane, be hit by another car. and killed. A lot of good insurance will do them then. So what is, would you sell it to me?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not an expert on underwriting. I'll have to put that out front, but, you know, there is a growing insurance market. I'm defending my first case that involves professional liability for a plumber. In effect, plumber's malpractice insurance that didn't used to exist for the claim that used to be excluded under the CGL for your own work product. Mm-hmm. You know, a niche that has been filled for payment of a premium by the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like...
Well, maybe I can.
Yeah, it's sort of like insurance for drunk drivers. You know, you say there's a tough risk, but they make money on it because they can't get their license back unless they have the insurance.
Every time we have an insurance case, I always call my insurance agent and say, will you cover me? Whatever the court holds, so I get covered. But sometimes they won't sell it to me. Okay. Go ahead, Justice Wilcox.
No, I was just, if we're talking about the policy, which we really aren't, we're talking about the, quote, public policy, we're talking about precedent, but in the policy itself that Wisconsin Mutual had, it's my understanding that it had to be a hit. I mean, that was something, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why, you know, the cases have sort of focused more on the statute than reasonable expectations. There hasn't been any argument on behalf of the plaintiff that the plaintiff could have looked at that policy and said they had any reasonable expectation of coverage under this circumstance, because the policy language definitely required an impact.
We've had cases with impact. One, something fell off, they thought, of a truck that was not identified, right?
Well, there was a leaf spring.
Hit the piece, yeah.
The Tice case.
Right. You hit the piece, that was enough of a bang. Then you had a case where the unidentified driver hit car A, and A hit be the plaintiff in the case.
Yes.
And that says, well, that was enough of a bang. I mean, it's once removed. Both cases are once removed from the actual unidentified driver. So now this case is portrayed with facts that you have now agreed to, at least for purposes of this review, that the bang is hitting the mirror of a third car. Right?
Right.
So isn't the issue in this case is whether the bang is good enough?
Without an impact on the insured vehicle of any sort.
Well, the insured vehicle did have an impact when it hit the ditch. There was an impact.
Well, that's what I said, I think, in response to the first question, that if you parse the statute that way, you don't need an impact of the unidentified car with anyone. You could just say a classic miss and run satisfies the statute.
Yeah, so you think we were mistaken in our other cases in demanding an impact?
No, Your Honor. The other cases, this is the first case where there's been no impact of any kind by, you know, some foreign object, whether it's a leaf spring or another car, on the insured vehicle. In contrast, the Dynal case, 231 with second 14, is where ice allegedly came off a tractor-trailer, smashed through the windshield of the insured vehicle, so, you know, there wasn't much question of a fraudulent claim there, but the Court of Appeals said, no, that's a natural phenomena, and we're not going to call that an impact on the insured vehicle, and said no uninsured motorist coverage.
Mr. Skiles, you just touched on something that gives me some concern. Our case law basically is based on the idea that we don't want fraudulent claims. And I'm wondering, why shouldn't we let juries decide whether a claim being brought is a fraudulent claim? Why should we set this whole structure up as a matter of law?
Well, Your Honor, the court could do that and just say all miss and runs are compensable, because if you look at the miss and run cases...
If the jury finds, indeed, there should be coverage.
Right. Well, first of all, I think it would contradict the legislative intent. If you look at the miss and run cases, Amitschek, Haynes, Romanchek, they were carefully selected that there was no issue of fraud there. No one who said the accident didn't happen. For obvious reasons, no one's going to take a case in the Supreme Court of someone who's drunk and wraps their car around a tree and said, some priest ran me off the road, and then asked this court to give them coverage. So there was no issue of fraud, but the court said, no, the legislature in their policymaking role was trying to limit the scope of these claims, and that was a proper legislative function. Now, I mean, there are all sorts of issues where juries aren't allowed to decide the whole issue of discretionary government acts. Juries don't decide those. I had a case up north where the government cut a tree right across the road and a car ran into it. If a private citizen does that, it's probably negligence as a matter of law. When a government employee does that, the Court of Appeals says discretionary act, immunity. I mean, so...
We have our own discussions among the court members. On
don't bring that up.
We don't want to open that door.
Well, what do you think about the economic loss doctrine?
That's for the next case.
Well, I just lost one of those in a court of appeals, too.
Mr. Skiles, if I could, when I look at the cases and I look at the precedent, and I know both parties are arguing precedent here, but when I look at the cases, I do not see a case that really involves the facts that are before the court here today, where you have vehicle A impacting vehicle B, and then vehicle C swerves off and is involved in an accident. And my concern is that we're to interpret the statute, because that's what we're dealing with here, the statute. And the statute says an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident. Now, I've looked at the cases that are cited by the parties in each of their briefs from our jurisdiction that really, I'm not sure really answer the question that's before the court here. Are you familiar with cases from other jurisdictions that might help point us in the direction that you would like us to go?
Well, I know that Iowa recently affirmed an impact requirement under their statute.
Is their statute the same words as our statute?
Yeah, they have a requirement of a hit and run. There's like four different types of statutes nationwide. And Iowa recently, you know, same arguments were presented to them, and they said, no, we're going to have a hit on the, you know, insured vehicle. But I agree, you know, this precise factual scenario has not been amongst the, you know, the handful of cases that both sides have cited. You know, neither of our table of authorities have been very extensive because there's just not that much litigation that has resulted in published opinions. So it's agreed that, you know, you're making a decision that really is of first impression, you know, under this circumstance.
Counsel, I want to return, since this case, I think, is all about the interpretation of the statute. Would you agree with that or disagree with that, that this case centers on the interpretation of the statute?
And a legislative intent.
Well, but the interpretation of the statute, which very
yes.
well may include legislative
yes.
intent, is the, and I'm referring now to sub B, and it reads as follows, an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident. In other words, in this paragraph, uninsured motor vehicle also includes, and then sub B, an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident. Is that language ambiguous or unambiguous, do you think? And then I'm going to ask you, have our courts construed that to be unambiguous or ambiguous? First question, do you think it's ambiguous or unambiguous?
I think it could be considered ambiguous, and this court has looked at legislative intent in Romanchak and Haynes.
Mm-hmm. What have our courts said what have the cases said with regard to whether or not this language is ambiguous or unambiguous, if you know?
Honestly, I don't recollect the exact statement of the court at Haynes on it. I won't take a stab at it.
That's okay if you don't know. Lots of times we don't know things. So let's go through this statute. An unidentified motor vehicle. Does that pose any problems with regard to ambiguity in this case, other than it's unidentified, but in terms of, is an agreement that there is an unidentified motor vehicle here?
Yes.
Okay, there's an agreement. Now, involved. What does involved mean?
That can be an open question, Your Honor.
Well, haven't we decided that? Look at paragraph 12 of the Smith case. And we're construing that very word. Paragraph 12 says, Wisconsin statute, citing the statute, defines an uninsured motor vehicle as an unidentified vehicle involved in a hit-and-run accident. The use of the word involved does not strike us as a word that should be narrowly applied only to a hit-and-run accident involving a direct hit to the insured vehicle. And then it says here, the unidentified motor vehicle was clearly involved. It precipitated the accident through the contact with the intermediate vehicle. So it seems to me that unless you can show me to the contrary, where another court overruled this interpretation, that the word involved, according to paragraph 12, is not to be narrowly applied only to a hit-and-run accident involving a direct hit to the insured vehicle.
Well, that was in the context of Smith, where you did have a direct hit to the insured vehicle, but not by the unidentified vehicle.
But what I'm looking for is, you know, how do you define the words? I mean, we can ask you, you know, what do you think we should do here? You know, or we can ask you, you know, does it make a difference and give you a variety of fact situations as was set forth in the respective briefs. But I'm looking at, you know, it seems to me that we've interpreted the word involved. And I'm just asking you if you can show me a case that interprets it in a contrary fashion that came after the Smith case.
Well, no, I can't, because Smith has a different number than Tice.
Yeah, Tice came before. In fact,
Smith, that's what I mean, 127 versus 15.
Smith cited Tice for the very premise that Justice Crooks was talking about. And that gets to the word hit. What does hit mean? And Tice said in footnote 10, hit, well, hit's there because we've got this policy against fraud, and so we need some kind of hit requirement so there can't be fraudulent claims, right?
Yes.
But that, so,
and your policy is very different than the statute. Your policy limits the, it doesn't talk about an unidentified motor vehicle involved in a hit and run. Your policy says hit and run vehicle is one whose operator is unknown and which strikes you or a relative.
Yeah, it's very similar to the policy in Progressive and Roman Schock and Haynes.
A vehicle which you or a relative are occupying, or it hits your insured car when you're not in it. I mean, I'm assuming that. So under your policy, it's quite clear. Well, it's relatively clear that it doesn't cover. But the question is whether your policy is good under the statute. Or maybe you disagree with that analysis.
No, I agree. It's clear the policy doesn't cover it. And the issue is statutory interpretation.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Trollope, you represent Wendy S. DeHart and Gary C. DeHart.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Lance Trollope, and I represent the respondents, Wendy and Gary DeHart. Uninsured motorist coverage is required in the instant matter for three main reasons. The first is the plain language of 632.32 requires uninsured motorist coverage here. The second is that Wisconsin case law interpreting that statute requires uninsured motorist coverage here. And the third, and this is basically a subset of the first two, is that the primary purpose of that statute is satisfied by requiring uninsured motorist coverage here.
Are you interpreting this as a chain reaction? I know that in your brief you talk about Smith. You relate this to the, what is the significant difference between this case and Smith?
The significant difference between this case and Smith, as pointed out by Wisconsin Mutual, is that in Smith there was actual contact to the insured vehicle.
Are there any cases that you can point to that there have not, that there hasn't been a hit? In other words, of some object on the insured?
No, there has not been a case that has addressed that issue either way. There has never been a case that has said that there is coverage without a hit to the insured. And similarly, there's never been a case that has said there is no coverage when the unidentified vehicle makes a hit.
And why is that significant in this context, looking at 632.32?
Well, this court, there are valid arguments to say that the phrase hit and run doesn't actually require a hit, although those arguments have been rejected by this court. And so the statute does say there has to be a hit, but the statute, in nowhere in the statute does it say that the hit has to be to the insured vehicle.
Now, the Chief Justice asked your opposing counsel the last question, which he didn't really answer, but I'd like you to think about that. She said, now, in your insurance policy, it doesn't read the same as perhaps a statute. In other words, the statute talks about 2B, talks about a hit and miss. And has there been any interpretation that you know of that has not said that this means a hit on the insured vehicle?
No. In fact, the question has never been presented, so there's never been an opportunity to decide that question. The interpretation has always said there has to be a hit, but it's never been decided one way or the other whether that hit has to be directly to the insured vehicle. That issue has never been presented.
What is there any relationship in Smith between the chain reaction and, say, I gave the example or asked opposing counsel, if you had a hit to a vehicle and then later on, whether it's a half mile or 2 miles, you had a miss to another vehicle, does there have to be some relationship? Or can there be a hit at 11 o'clock to a vehicle that's unidentified and then a miss at 12 o'clock on the same road to another vehicle?
Well, a literal reading of the statute would say that that would qualify for coverage. There is no suggestion in the statute that there has to be an analysis of the time or distance between that first hit and the later miss.
Does that make sense as far as what you would expect coverage? In other words, Justice Prosser asked about what the average person that buys this insurance would expect. So you think you should be able to connect 11 o'clock hit with a 12 o'clock miss?
Well, respectfully, most of the people that come to my office would just think that a miss and run also was a hit and run. So they would actually expect there to be coverage. They consider it a term of art, and a hit and run, a miss and run, it's all the same thing.
Counsel, I'm not sure I understand or agree with your answer to Justice Wilcox. And I'm looking at the statute again, because the statute is not just sub A to B in isolation. You also have the premises listed in A, an uninsured motorist for the protection of persons injured who are legally entitled to recover damages from owners or operators of uninsured motor vehicles because of bodily injury, sickness, or disease, including death, resulting therefrom within the limits. And then in sub 2, it defines what an uninsured motor vehicle is. So I don't see how you can have a claim that involves some striking that's not involved in the accident of the insured vehicle, because you wouldn't be legally entitled to recover damages.
Well, before answering that, I would like to at least point out that I don't think that is the situation that we have presented here. We have,
I understand
we
that,
have one continuous accident. But to address
that, I think you over-answered Justice Wilcox's question. And
to address that issue, I would point out that the definition that you just read states that the injured person just has to be legally entitled to collect damages from this other vehicle. It doesn't say that the injured person or that the insured person has to have been hit by the other vehicle. Here, in this case, Ms. DeHart is legally entitled to collect compensation from this other vehicle. But the question then is this other vehicle an uninsured vehicle? And the statute then goes on to include in the definition of an uninsured vehicle one that was involved in a hit-and-run accident. This vehicle in the instant matter was involved in a hit-and-run accident. The statute doesn't say that that hit-and-run accident had to be a second before or immediately before, although in this case it was one accident.
But I guess the gist of my question is involved in a hit-and-run accident. It would seem that when you read sub A1 with sub A2, it would have to be involved
with the hit-and-run accident. Otherwise, you could take any hit-and-run from any part of the state and link it to the facts of this case. And I don't read the statute that way. There has to be a relationship, as I see the statute, correct me if I'm wrong, between the accident that occurred, the striking vehicle A, that strikes vehicle B, that's involved with the your insured C, because if they're not related, there's no legitimate claim for damages from C to A. Correct?
I'm certainly not going to say you're wrong, but I do disagree with that analysis. And again, I would note in this case, it's sort of separate from what we're deciding in this case, because this was one accident, one continuous event. But in that situation, the statute could say that the insured vehicle has to be hit by an uninsured or hit by an uninsured vehicle or has to be hit by the hit-and-run vehicle. It doesn't say that. The statute says it has to be legally entitled to collect from a hit-and-run vehicle. And I believe that is the difference. That is why there is no time or distance analysis.
Well, isn't there a time or distance analysis inherent in the word involved? If one of my kids is in a is driving down the street and a car comes and hits the car immediately in front of that, I say, then the same facts, if someone pulls off, the child pulls off to the right and there's a involved. But if you would separate that by 24 hours, I'm not sure I would say that being separate the injury from the hitting by 24 hours, I'd say, doesn't sound like that's involved to me. If you'd separate that by 3 hours, that someone drives down the highway 3 hours after there had been a hit and for some reason pulls off to the right into the ditch, I wouldn't say that's involved.
And I think the thing that I'm focusing on is the fact that it does not say, the statute does not say that the insured vehicle has to be involved in a hit-and-run accident. It says that the hit-and-run vehicle, the unidentified vehicle, has to be involved in a hit-and-run accident.
That's right. The focus is on the unidentified vehicle.
And to use the example that you gave of 24 hours later, well, I would suggest that is no longer a hit-and-run vehicle. If you're in an accident in one county and the next day you're in another accident, it's no longer a hit-and-run vehicle. Now, if you're in an accident and 3 hours later you're still running from the scene, is it still a hit-and-run vehicle? I think it was.
I can't imagine a scenario. It seems too fantastical to me, a scenario that I'm involved in a hit-and-run accident 3 hours after the hit.
Unless
it's this debris that's on, like we had in the Tice case, I guess.
And I think that goes to the difference of, I suppose, of where my focus is again, the statute doesn't say that the insured vehicle has to be involved in a hit-and-run accident. It says that the unidentified vehicle has to be involved in a hit-and-run accident. And again, the facts as presented here isn't a situation where you have one hit in one county and another hit in another county. It's one continuous accident. It's probably not surprising that I was thinking of these issues on my drive down here yesterday, and I saw several accidents or aftermaths of accidents. And one of them involved multiple vehicles, six or seven vehicles, sort of strewn about the road, some in the road, some on both sides. And when I drove by, never in my mind did I think of that as more than one accident. It was one accident. They might have been spaced apart by 10 seconds. Maybe one came on the scene and lost control, but it was one accident. And that's what's presented in this situation. One accident. This unidentified driver starts to cross the center line, hits the mirror of the first car, forces the second car from the road, and forces the insured car to lose control. And Ms. DeHart, in her deposition, stated that when this unidentified car started to cross the center line, which would be when it struck that mirror, to the point that it passed her was too fast or too short for her to have hit her brakes and avoided the collision. This was all one continuous act. One continuous accident. The reason that I've argued that Wisconsin case law requires uninsured coverage here really is focused on the Smith decision. Now, Ms. DeHart does not say that the result of Smith is binding on this court or any other court. Instead, Ms. DeHart argues is that the reasoning applied in Smith.
Well, there were you stated in your brief, and I know we don't want to go over that exactly, but there were three reasons. But if you applied those, all three, you're saying then Smith would, under the reasoning of Smith, then this would fall under that reasoning.
Yes, I would argue that the reasoning of Smith certainly applies here and is satisfied. Smith said that there are three elements to consider when deciding whether a vehicle is a hit-and-run vehicle. Is there an unidentified vehicle? Is that vehicle involved in a hit? And does that vehicle flee the scene? All three of those are satisfied here. Smith also said there are two public policy things to consider. The first has been discussed, which is the issue of fraud. This is not a situation where there is fraud. This is a situation where there was a hit. So not only were there witnesses, like there have been in other cases, there's an actual hit here. There cannot be an allegation that this was a single vehicle accident out on the road by itself that is now claiming it was the fault of someone else. The second public policy, which other cases have said is the main intent of the statute, is to ensure that the insured injured person is compensated as though the unidentified or uninsured vehicle was insured. The only way to do that here is to provide coverage. It's the only way that the DeHarts are going to be placed in the same situation they would have been had that vehicle not been unidentified or had that vehicle been insured.
On the Smith case, refers positively to Judge Fine's dissent, which said when the statute was adopted, they didn't use the industry language, which is the language that's in the policy, but they used the language that was set forth in the statute, which left unclear the issue of hit and miss. And then the Legislative Council, the Insurance Legislative Council Committee, said, leave it to the courts.
Yes, and what Judge Fine pointed out, and which was repeated by this court in Smith, was that there were policies at the time that required a direct hit to the insured, and the legislature did not do that. The legislature could have included that language. It could have said that there's coverage when the unidentified vehicle strikes the insured vehicle. It didn't. It chose not to. And what Judge Fine reasoned was, and what this court pointed out, was that by not doing that, the legislature did not intend to limit coverage to the situation where there was a direct hit to the insured vehicle.
Now, when you leave it to the courts, it's at least is it fair to say that the court has been consistent in requiring a hit on the insured vehicle?
No. It is fair to say that the courts have been consistent in requiring a hit.
Somewhere.
The courts have never addressed the situation of there having to be a hit to the insured vehicle. And a good example of this, although it's a Court of Appeals decision, is the Wegner case. In the Wegner decision, the unidentified vehicle swerved, caused a secondary vehicle to then hit the insured vehicle. The unidentified vehicle never contacted any other vehicle. So in that case, there actually was a hit to the insured vehicle, but there was no coverage. The reason there was no coverage is because the unidentified vehicle wasn't involved in a hit.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that's, and that finding is mandated by the statute, which says that the unidentified vehicle has to be in a hit-and-run accident, not the insured vehicle.
But in, I'm just referring to page 6 of your opponent's brief, where he says when you read both Hain and Romeshek, that the court decisively analyzed the need for a physical contact with the insured vehicle.
And that's simply
erroneous?
It's simply erroneous. What the courts analyzed was the need for an impact. At no point in that decision, or either of those decisions, does it specifically say that the impact has to be to the insured vehicle, and that's understandable because that wasn't an issue. That wasn't an issue in that case. In those cases, there was no impact at all.
Does there have to be an impact by the unidentified vehicle?
That is one thing the courts have been consistent in holding.
So, and that you find the impact in that mirror?
Yes, there was an impact. Ms. DeHart was forced from the road by a vehicle that was a hit-and-run vehicle. In fact, it was still fleeing from the scene when it forced her from the road.
Well, Chief, what was your question again, please?
My question was, do the cases stand for the proposition that the unidentified vehicle has to make contact, has to hit someone or something, but not necessarily the plaintiff in this particular action?
Yes.
That there has to be some impact, and your response was yes. And that my next question then was, so the impact in this case, according to you, has to be the hitting of that mirror in the other car.
Yes.
So you got, that's your position, is you got impact. That's all you need. With someone, somewhere, and then an involvement.
Well, and that sort of goes back to the question before from Justice Bradley. Yes, I would argue that the statute would be satisfied from an impact, even if there was a long time later that there was a later run from the road. But in this case, we don't have to make that argument, because here it was one continuous accident. It was a hit to the first car, forcing of the road from the second car, and then causing Ms. DeHart to lose control. And as she noted in her deposition, the time between those two was too fast for her to even have hit her brakes and just stop to avoid it. This was all one continuous act. She was involved in an accident with a hit-and-run driver, even though the statute doesn't say she has to have been.
Justice Brasser.
What could be hit? Does it have to be a vehicle?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think if you take a literal reading of the statute, it would not have to be a vehicle. The statute simply says that the unidentified vehicle has to be a hit-and-run vehicle. So I suppose if that hit-and-run vehicle struck a building and then ran from that scene, that would be considered to be a hit-and-run vehicle. I don't believe that issue's ever been addressed, but the phrase hit-and-run, I think, would be satisfied by a vehicle that hits something and then runs.
Mailbox?
I think that would still be
sign.
That would be a hit-and-run vehicle. And what that hit does is that hit satisfies the fear of fraud. The requirement for a hit-and-run vehicle, most cases have essentially said that the requirement for that is to avoid the situation like was discussed by opposing counsel of some drunk driver out on the road who goes off the road and wraps his car around a telephone pole and says, there was a vehicle that swerved at me. Well, if there is a hit, if you can actually prove a hit, that takes that situation away. I don't know how likely that situation would be, depending on where that prior hit was, which also brings me back to Justice Bradley's question before, is what would be the chance of a situation where you had a hit and then 24 hours later a forcing from the road? The reality is that probably would never happen, because the car that was forced from the road hours later wouldn't know that that prior car was involved in a hit.
I understood your opposing counsel to answer a question to the effect that there was some ambiguity in the statute. And what is your position on that?
Well, the courts have consistently said that the statute is not ambiguous. It is, the courts have said that the plain language can be applied. The confusing part is then the decisions have also talked about the intent of the statute after saying that. But I think it was the Hain decision that said that it is not an ambiguous statute.
That it is not.
That it is not.
And what did Romanchak have to say about the statute?
I don't recall whether Romanchak decided whether it was ambiguous or not.
No, it said it was plain and unambiguous meaning. So it said, reading from paragraph 39, for 20 years this Court has consistently adhered to the plain and unambiguous meaning of 632.32(4)(a)(2.2)(b).
And that would be consistent with Hain, which has said essentially that you have to read the statute literally, which is that it says hit and run, so there has to be a hit. So we can also read the statute literally to see that it does not say that the hit has to be to the insured vehicle. It simply says that the unidentified vehicle has to be involved in a hit and run accident, which is why I think if we take that unambiguous analysis and we apply it to hitting a mailbox or hitting a sign, that vehicle would be a hit and run vehicle.
Of course, a statute can be unambiguous in many circumstances, but then be ambiguous in another fact situation. The Court has said that, too.
The Court has said that, and I apologize, the case escapes me, but there also was a decision from this Court stating the exact opposite of that, which is that a factual change does not make a statute that was unambiguous later be ambiguous. Which is why I was a bit confused in reading the statutes when the Court would say that it was an unambiguous statute, but then it would discuss the intent of the statute. But I do think the intent of the statute is important. And what this Court has found is the intent is to provide coverage for people that are involved in accidents with uninsured vehicles as though those vehicles were insured. And the only way to do so in this case is to provide uninsured coverage here.
Do you have the words of the statute in front of you or in your mind well enough? What I'm going to ask you might require you to have it in front of you. I'm going to ask you to If you want to make this statute consistent with the policy of insurance, now the policy of insurance says the strike has to be of you or a relative, it has to, the vehicle has to strike the vehicle which you or a relative are occupying, or this unknown vehicle has to strike your insured car. If you were going to take that language or that idea that there has to be a strike to your car, how would you modify the statute that is 632.32.4 to be consistent with the policy of insurance?
Well, quite easily, actually. You'd have to make the statute much more restrictive. Subsection 4A2B would have to say that an uninsured vehicle includes one that strikes the insured vehicle and flees, or a hit-and-run vehicle that strikes the insured vehicle. That is policy language that was present at the time this statute was drafted, which is what Judge Fine, in his dissent to the Court of Appeals decision in Smith, pointed out as evidence of the fact that the legislature did not want to restrict the statute or restrict coverage that way. The legislature could have easily done that. It presumably was aware of statutes requiring that, or excuse me, of policies requiring that, and yet it didn't. It did not limit it to just a contact from the unidentified vehicle to the insured vehicle. The policy in this case does require that, and that policy provision is void pursuant to the Smith decision, which clearly says that there does not have to be direct contact to the insured vehicle. If we were to apply this policy language to the Smith decision, there would be no coverage, because this policy says there has to be a direct hit, and in Smith there was not a direct hit. Wisconsin Mutual has also argued that the insurance companies have relied on this impact to the insured in setting policy premiums, and I did want to address that point briefly. And one is, which as we've already discussed, is no case has actually held that. There have been cases that have held there has to be an impact, but no case has actually held there must be impact to the insured vehicle. So if insurance companies have relied on that, they've done so wrongly. Also, this fact situation that we have presented to us is quite rare. There were over 125,000 motor vehicle accidents in Wisconsin in 2005. This is the first time that this court or any appeals court has ever addressed an issue or a situation where an unidentified vehicle hits one vehicle and then swerves and misses the insured vehicle and causes it to lose control. It's never been addressed before. The reason is because it's a very, very rare fact situation. Could it come up again? Certainly, which I think is why we're here today. But it's simply too rare to affect insurance policy premiums.
Counselor, what if we have the same facts and you have the first hit of the vehicle and then the vehicle that does the hitting moves back into its lane, but the driver of your client, Ms. DeHartz, sees this hit and it makes her very afraid. The guy doesn't swerve into her lane, but because she's afraid, she goes off the road. Is there coverage?
Well, two answers to that question. Is there coverage pursuant to the statute? Yes. Would that coverage ever come into effect? Probably no. I don't know of I certainly wouldn't take that case on. I don't know of a jury that would find that.
You don't think there's causation? Is that your problem?
I think a jury would find that the negligence of the person that just panicked and drove off the road from an accident that was a long ways away from her would probably find that plaintiff was more negligent than the other parties, or at least.
But you think that there would be coverage?
I think a little reading of the statute would be that there is still coverage. If that vehicle, if that unidentified vehicle mm-hmm. had hit the prior vehicle mm-hmm. and flees the scene, you know, has to actually leave the scene and not be identified, I think it would still be fleeing the scene at the time that it caused, if we say that it caused the plaintiff's accident. I think that'd be the tricky part, though, is the mm-hmm. cause.
And if you had the same vehicle, but the vehicle saw your client drive off the road and the driver stopped, then you don't have somebody that's running, so then the statute doesn't apply.
Then the statute would apply if that person who stopped was uninsured, but they're no longer unidentified. So this one specific part of the statute won't apply.
Right. So they're not a running person.
They're not an unidentified vehicle. If the vehicle stops and gives you their information and just says, well, we're not insured, then you have an uninsured situation, and most policies would actually cover that.
Well, they would cover it if there was causation by the uninsured driver, not just because someone drives by you that's uninsured.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I see that my time is almost up. If I can briefly conclude.
You've got about 4 minutes, so you don't have to take them, though.
Well, then I'll conclude. Just wanted to, again, conclude and point out the 2 points that I mentioned earlier, is that a literal reading of the statute does provide coverage here. The statute does not require a direct hit to the insured vehicle. It only requires that the unidentified vehicle be involved in a hit. Also, the reasoning of Smith, not the result of Smith, but the reasoning of Smith, mandates uninsured coverage here. And the third point, which I'd said is sort of a subset of the first two, is that the intent, the purpose of the statute, is to provide coverage for people like Ms. DeHart, who are injured through the fault of another vehicle that is unidentified. And the only way to do that here is to mandate uninsured coverage.
Yeah, and this fully supports the Romashek and Haynes case, is what your position is, right?
It does, because in those cases, the court found that there had to be a hit, that the unidentified vehicle had to make contact. And in here, there was contact in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Skiles?
Mr. Skiles, before you answer his argument, you say in your brief that in Romashek and in Haynes, and I'm reading from page 7, that why, and I'll read this is the last paragraph, fast forward to the summer of 2005, the court in Romashek exhaustively explained why the contact requirement was still good law and refused to overturn decades of precedent requiring some contact between the insured vehicle, and I emphasize the insured vehicle, and some other vehicle, paragraph 1, and that this was a, and I'm paraphrasing, a legislative requirement. That's what your brief says. Do you still stand by that?
Yes, Your Honor, because every case involves some contact with the insured vehicle. And the court in Romanchek specifically said that if we want to just have all miss and runs compensable, it's for the legislature to change that.
All right. Go ahead. I'm just...
Your Honor, I think that the questioning of able opposing counsel is that we're all agreed that if the statute were to be read literally, the floodgates would be open to a wide variety of claims. As I mentioned, just the example of what happens on our Beltline in any blizzard could potentially occur. A statute is not to be construed in such a manner that it leads to absurd results. And one advantage of maintaining an impact requirement on the insured vehicle is that it is a bright-line test that can be easily administered by attorneys, insurance adjusters, and the courts. And it eliminates the need to do everything on a case-by-case basis. And I think that's important for purposes of predictability of the law, which I think is a valid public policy concern.
What about predictability in how you gauge how much the policy is going to cost? Is it, in other words, the accounting predictability on how you factor in accidents?
Well, that's also a real question. The courts have noted, for instance, that miss and run accidents are not rare. You know, they're quite common. And the court in Romanchek in a footnote 10 noted that one of the reasons for maintaining some sort of physical contact requirement is to prevent drivers from claiming hit-and-run coverage from suffering accidents of their own making. And that I would say that when you have loss of control accidents in a winter context, that's something that happens commonly in Wisconsin, even to people when there aren't other drivers on the scene. And that's certainly a concern that I think is legitimate.
Counsel, if I could, in response to the floodgates argument, and I go back and ask the opposing counsel about this, And for me, when I read the statute, I don't think you can read 4.2b in isolation. As I said to opposing counsel, you've got 4.a.1. And Justice Rogenstein also referred to this. This whole question of causation, the
insured still has to be legally entitled to recover from the uninsured motorist. So if they have to be legally entitled to recover from that uninsured motorist, you have to have some element of causation. So when we talk about the floodgates, given sub 4A1, I'm not sure the floodgates open as broadly as your argument suggests.
Well, that would be up for the courts to determine, but if you say that an accident happened to someone else, and because of that accident I took some driving input, and then I got in an accident without contact.
Let me phrase the question in a different manner, because maybe I'm not making it clear. You have the same facts as this, except that the driver that has the impact, the driver that's approaching the insured that has the impact with car B, pulls over and stops and gives their name. So all of the information is there. So you have, as Justice Rovitzak averred earlier, you have an uninsured motorist. You can identify them. Now, unless that driver, that uninsured motorist, has caused driver C's, the insured's accident, you still don't have a claim, correct?
Correct.
So isn't that the limiting aspect of the statute? You still have to have causation. You can't read 4B2 in isolation from 4A2 from 4A1.
Well, in any claim, you have to establish causation.
Isn't that the limiting aspect of the statute?
But, of course, one issue of fraud in cases where the other driver's no longer around is you've only got often one side of the story about what occurred.
Was that true in this case?
Well, as I pointed out in my facts summary, there are a number of contradictions about exactly what occurred, which, again, we're not supposed to be considering if this is motion to dismiss, but what is confirmation? Is it the spouse of the plaintiff confirming it, the brother? Or is it someone completely independent? I mean, that's a slippery slope if you're talking about, you know, what is confirmation and what is not confirmation. I see I'm done. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you,
Mr. Scales, and thank you, Mr. Trollope, for your arguments today and yet another case involving the unidentified motor vehicle. Mr. Scales, have you appeared before the court before?
25 years ago.
I remember you well.
She's the only one that remembers.
Mr. Trollope, have you appeared before the court before? Well, my congratulations to both of you. One who's never appeared and one who hasn't appeared here before a long time. I remember my own appearances here. They're not easy. Thank you both.
Taking a break?
Yes, I'm sorry. We'll take a short recess because we're anticipating another group of students coming in. Is that right? Yes, we have UW-Whitewater Law students. Those who wish to leave may do so.